You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, listener-supported radio in Vancouver, Canada. After the State of the Media and Climate Change panel discussion, March 6th, Ross Gelbspan was kind enough to hang around for a short interview. You'll hear the crowd departing and the film crew packing up in the background. They're making a movie about Ross Gelbspan. I began by asking Ross whether the American mass media were finally getting out of their state of denial about global warming.
In the United States, I think the press is basically in stage two denial. They acknowledge climate change is happening, but they really underestimate the magnitude and the urgency of what's going on. And you can see that in the way it's covered in feature stories about the melting ice caps and what's happening to the forests in the Northwest and so forth. But I don't think it at all has become central enough in media coverage, and certainly not in terms of the magnitude and urgency of what's happening. That is not being covered.
Well, I'd like to return to that point in just a minute. But first, I know you've really specialized in digging up how fossil fuel companies have influenced the media. And we sort of came to a point, I was hoping, especially after this IPCC report, that the denial would stop, it would slow down, and yet we have right this week in Britain a new feature being brought out by Channel 4 called The Great Global Warming Swindle. And so, you know, is this going to go away, or are these people just going to reinvent themselves? Are we going to have to fight them off at the same time as we're trying to rearrange the society to survive?
It's a very good question. Jim Hansen told me recently that he was invited to debate a skeptic and he refused to do it. Because he felt it would legitimize that point of view. Basically, the skeptics have really been a moving target. At the beginning, they said global warming wasn't happening. Then they said it's going to be good for us. Then they said, oh, it's going to be negligible. And what I think you have to understand is that if we were to do what nature tells us we must, which is reduce our use of coal and oil by 70% to 80%, that puts an end to one of the biggest commercial enterprises in history. And there is no doubt that the oil industry and the coal industry are fighting for their survival. They will use every tactic they can. And so I don't expect them to go away. But I do expect them to become less and less relevant as the debate focuses less on whether climate change is happening and more on what we should be doing about it.
And you say that the plan that you put together in your book, Boiling Point, which I have followed, you've laid out three very reasonable steps. How is it being accepted? You mentioned on the stage that several world leaders have looked at it. How is it coming along, and how do you see it progressing?
Again, I think it's a question of timing. You know, this issue is really changing all the time, so that ideas that were completely outrageous 5 years ago are now becoming conventional wisdom. And so my feeling about this plan that I've articulated in Boiling Point and on the stage tonight, I think it seems very far out to people. I think in another couple of years it will not at all seem far out to people. And I think one has to be patient and understand that this is really a work in progress in terms of, I don't mean the solutions themselves, but I mean the timing is a critical issue, and things that really seem totally unacceptable at a certain point in time really become very attractive at another point in time. And I think the speed with which the climate is changing is going to make ideas of this kind acceptable probably within the next 5 to 10 years.
And we had an intimation on the stage tonight that it's quite likely that corporate strategists are working out how to take a slice of this pie. Do you see them leaping in at some point?
I see a really interesting thing happening in the corporate world. I know that, for example, Goldman Sachs is trying right now to figure out how to maximize their profits in a carbon trading market. I know there are a whole bunch of companies that are working in that direction. What I see coming down the road, and this is my hypothesis, I don't have solid evidence for it, is I see a major conflict between many of the world's large multinational corporations and the fossil fuel industry. And I say that because of this reason. There are a lot of huge multinational corporations that have saturated the market in the U.S. and Canada and Australia and Europe and Japan, and they see all their future earnings growth coming from developing countries. It is developing countries that are getting hit hardest with climate impacts. It is beginning to shrink purchasing power and erode markets. And at a certain point, I can see the rest of the multinational community saying to big coal and big oil, stop it. Enough. You guys are interfering with the only place we have to grow. And so I do see that as an emerging conflict that's still below the surface, but I expect it to surface in not too long of a time.
Yes, if you're going to expect people in Africa or Asia to buy your wares, and at the same time they're having cities with major storms or flooding or other heat-related incidents, they're going to have less consumer dollars, if you will, to buy the products that you want to sell.
Absolutely. I also see another very interesting response brewing, and this is from the countries of Europe against the United States. And it's early as 2001, right before the Kyoto Protocol took effect. I had discussions with representatives from the French and Swiss and Canadian governments, and they told me they were planning on bringing the U.S. to court under the World Trade Organization, excuse me, as soon as Kyoto took effect. And their argument was going to be the WTO prohibits governments from subsidizing their products. If all these countries were drawing down their emissions according to the Kyoto schedule and the U.S. was not, they were going to charge the U.S. with carbon subsidizing their products and move to put very stiff taxes on U.S. exports. That whole initiative got put on the back burner by the terrorist attacks and the Coalition of the Willing, but I see that within the last 6 months, French President Villepin, followed by Chirac, are making the same threats now in 2006-2007. So I think that also is a very interesting area to keep your eye on.
You know, I follow this issue, and you're telling me things that I just haven't heard before, and I suspect you've got some more. Is there something else that you think our listeners really ought to know about?
I think what the whole world needs to know about is the really positive potential of doing the right thing. And when I say that, I mean really thinking globally and really thinking of what are the paybacks of rewiring the world with clean energy. And that's part of the solutions I was talking about today, and it's part of what's in Boiling Point. But I think what's really important to understand is, were we to do that, one of the key facts to understand is that in poor countries, every dollar invested in energy creates far more jobs and far more wealth than the same dollar invested in any other sector of the economy. So were we to spearhead a wholesale transfer of clean energy to poor countries, that would begin to turn impoverished and dependent countries into trading partners. It would very much undermine the economic desperation that gives rise to terrorism. It would vastly increase the overall wealth in the global economy, and I think it would lead to a much more secure and wealthy and peaceful world.
Another problem that was raised tonight is whether people will be disappointed if they take some personal actions and then they don't see some change. Climate change keeps getting worse anyway. We know that there's some warming in the pipeline no matter what we do. Do you think that humans really can develop into something that looks two or three generations ahead and are willing to act to make life for those generations better?
That is a really, really good question. And I think one of the most difficult problems about the climate crisis is that carbon dioxide stays up there for 100 years. So if we were magically to stop all our coal and oil burning tomorrow, we would still be subject to a long spell of costly and traumatic weather extremes and other planetary changes. And whether or not human beings have the capacity to think long-term and act long-term is a real test. Nature is really putting us to that test. So I can't answer your question, but I think it's a very important one, and I think it's underscored by this long-time residency. It's not like other environmental problems when you stop the pollution, in 3 years the river is cleaned up or something like that. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
No.
And I wanted to ask you, what's next for Ross Gelbspan? Do you have another book in the works?
I'm thinking very much about a book about after the crash. There's no doubt that we're going to have significant hits. And I think it's very important that we begin to organize ourselves in ways before that happens. Otherwise, I think we're going to be living in a totalitarian kind of system for a very long time. Because I think governments are forced to resort to totalitarian measures, whether they're inherently totalitarian or not, to keep order in the face of chaos. I think you saw that in New Orleans in Katrina, where you had the National Guard out, you had the police stopping people on the bridge, you had forced evacuations. And I'm not saying Mayor Nagin's is a dictator. I'm saying that's a inevitable response. So I think what's very, very important, and I do want to write about this, is that we need to start putting new kinds of values and new ways of social organization in place before this all happens. So, for example, I think it's very important that the ethic of cooperation become predominant over the ethic of competition. I think it's very important that we begin to stop thinking in terms of nationalism. I think the economy is becoming truly globalized. I think the globalization of communication makes it unbelievably possible for anybody in the world to communicate with anybody else in the world now through the internet and through email. I think the global climate sort of makes us all one. So I think we have to shed this sort of toxic nationalism that's a big obstruction. And all this implies a very different kind of social organization, different power relationships, a different sense of community that transcends and is different from ways we've thought about ourselves before. And that's what I'd like to start writing about. And I don't know where it's going to go.
Ross Gelbspan, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for doing the interview. I very much appreciate it.